On this episode of Still Loading, I'd rather light a candle than curse the darkness. Hello everyone and welcome to this new episode of Still Loading. We are still going with the summer of PlayStation 2. In fact, when this comes out, this is going to be closer-ish to Halloween time. This is either going to be late September, early October, I believe, and we are recording this in August, so it's a bit of ways away. But with me today is one of the co-founders of the podcast. You know, he hasn't been able to be on for a while now, but Justin is here with me. Justin, how are you doing today?
Good, man. How are you?
It's good to see you. It's good to record this with you. It's been a while since I've had you on for an episode. I had to have you on for a Summer of PS2 episode.
Oh, absolutely. This is what we grew up on.
Oh, yeah. And just for those who don't know, there's no bad blood between Justin and I. Our schedules just got crazy. I'm the one that took up the podcast, and then he had his own things to do. So yeah. he was busy being a programmer.
Adult life,
adulting.
Baby.
So we're going to talk about Castlevania: Curse of Darkness, and this is one of the games that you suggested. And when you sent me your list of five, I wanted this one specifically because no one else had a Castlevania game on their list. Because there's not a lot of, like, Castlevania had a weird dying off point for home consoles after Symphony of the Night. A lot of the more popular Castlevania games were on the handhelds.
Yep.
There was a lot of handheld stuff. And then up until Lords of Shadow, which was popular enough for the time, and then the sequel ruined it from what I've heard.
Yes.
Castlevania didn't have a big existence on home consoles for a while. And this is one of the often overlooked Castlevania games, I would assume. Based on, unless you're in gaming circles, you don't really talk about this game all that much.
And no, not really, which is a shame because it's honestly one of my favorite Castlevania games.
I enjoyed it too. I really, really liked it. So I guess to start off, before we dive into the game, what I've been doing with everyone, what is your earliest memory of the PlayStation 2, or when did you first play a PlayStation 2 or get one or something like that?
That's an excellent question. And honestly, I think my first memory with the PS2 is at your house.
Really?
Yes.
Really? What did we play?
I'm going to say DDR was
that
probably,
would not surprise me.
Probably our intro. Definitely a key for that. I'm trying to think what else. I would probably say James Bond, one of the 007 games.
We still have to keep doing our James Bond series, by the way, which we'll pick up after the Summer of PS2. I was thinking about doing some of them for the Summer of PS2, but I figured I'm going to cover them anyway, so why not give more breadth to the PS2 library, because it's a huge library, deserves it. So I figured we'd cover that later. Yeah. So keep going, though. Sorry I interrupted you.
No. Yeah. So my biggest, Christmas present was the N64. And so, from my parents' point of view, that was all right, we're good for home consoles for a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, I love the N64, and I wasn't going to push my luck and ask for, the next big thing for the PS2, especially because at the time I was, a pretty big Nintendo fanboy. I still kind of am. I love all the consoles, but at that time I was definitely the Nintendo fanboy.
And I remember you played a lot of GameCube stuff too, because I remember when we would hang out a lot, it was a lot of custom Robo and stuff like that, which I did not enjoy in the slightest, but everyone else loved. And I remember playing him, why do people like this? I have to go back and play it though. That was also that was probably 15 years ago.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. At least. So it's been a while. So apparently I was your entry into the world of PlayStation 2 and to this and also the summer of PS2.
So
we played a lot of DDR, man. I forgot about that.
DDR.
I still have some of the pads too. I mean, I'm looking at, we're over at your place right now and I see two pads over there.
And I still have the PS2 hooked up and DDR.
Were you playing it recently?
Yeah, DDR Max 2.
Oh, that's Max 2. Burning Heat?
Burning
that
Heat.
That was our favorite song.
Afro Nova and, was it Suguru?
Yeah, Tsuguru. Because it had the TSU type of it was spelled that way. I forget. I know what you're talking about. That. All right. I'm not going to butcher it by trying to sing it. But we are here to talk about Castlevania Curse of Darkness for the PlayStation 2. It was developed by Konami, and it was released in North America on November 1st, 2005. In Japan, it was actually released on November 24th, 2005. So late 20-some-ish days later, which is very odd. And in Europe, it was released next year in February. So less than a year later, it got it, but still, it was later on. The game is... It's basically kind of like a 3D Symphony of the Night, kind of, in terms of what it's kind of trying to go for, you know, especially the visuals of the numbers. A lot of the visuals remind me of that, of Symphony of the Night, which admittedly still have not played or beaten. I need to get on. I know. Do you own it?
I own it, but digitally they released it digitally for the 360.
No, I'll PS3. They also released it digitally for the PS4. I should just buy it on there. I want the original copy so bad. And it's like, it's pricey-ish, but it's not that pricey. It's like a $60, $70 game. But at the same time, like, that's not too bad for a popular game for the PlayStation 1. Yeah. So I might look into that again. Yeah, so this game, it was a 3D Castlevania. It was not the first 3D Castlevania, thank God, because that awful mantle goes to the N64.
It sure does.
Oh, my Lord, those are some bad games. And the game, it had a really cool system. It had the Innocent Devil system, right?
I love the Innocent Devil.
And I thought
Devil
that was
system.
Cool, too. So how would you describe the Innocent Devil system?
When I first played it and I tried to describe it to my friends, because I love this game, and I like wanted everyone to play it. The Innocent Devil system, to me, the closest thing I could relate it to at the time was Pokemon.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very much like Pokemon.
Yeah, so essentially, you get like baby Innocent Devil of different types throughout the game, and they all have like a basic ability to kind of help you along your way. So you have one that can help that you like cling to, so you can fly a little bit and go long gaps. They have one that's like more offensive focused, one more defensive focused.
I actually have the list here if you'd like to hear them all.
Yes.
So there's the fairy type, which was an innocent demon that supported Hector with healing. Hector's the main character. We'll get into the story later, though. The battle type demon, which utilized physical and offensive attacks. He has the most heart points. He or she, whatever, has the most heart points. There's a bird type, which can engage aerial types of enemies. There's a mage type, which uses long-distance magic attacks. There's a devil type, which utilizes just says powerful attacks, whatever that means. And then there is a pumpkin type, which is meant for a joke purpose, but does raise luck significantly. So that'll get you better items.
Exactly.
I liked the battle type, what I played of it. I did not beat this game. You've beaten this game, though, right?
Oh, yeah, numerous times, actually.
And they all look kind of interesting. Like, the fairy type's definitely helpful because it heals you. Mm-hmm. Battle type was just fun because it just wrecked things.
Yes.
It just mowed over enemies, and that thing could take a beating.
Yep. And my favorite thing about the Innocent Devil system was you get the base one to start out with, and another mechanic of the game is the weapons. Mm-hmm. So each weapon has like different attributes. So you have like the pole type weapons, you have the sword type weapons, the hand type weapons, like brass knuckles. And depending on what you killed enemies with, they would drop, I forget the term they used, but it was like essentially like demon's holes. I forget the exact term for it, but your devil would essentially collect it, and based on which collection it would get, as soon as you hit enough for like enough for its evolutionary track, it would evolve in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
So you could actually branch out and evolve your innocent devil like multiple ways. So you had a lot of variety to choose from, and it was a lot of mystery because you didn't know what it would evolve into until it actually did it.
Yeah.
Which I thought was just, like, at the time for me, that I loved that.
Because it was a surprise every time. You didn't know what you were going to get.
Exactly.
I mean, obviously, now you could look it up online and
calculate
it all out, but back then, you know, you didn't really... I mean, I guess you could have, but there was less of it out there to really find.
Right. And just the mysteriousness of it.
The mystery of it all. Yeah, and I thought that was a really cool battle mechanic just because it, like you said, that definitely is a side effect of what Pokemon did.
Right.
Because you can look at it in so many different games. Like, look at the Sonic Adventure games. You have the Chao Gardens and stuff like that. I mean, hell, even, what is it? I still haven't beaten it, but Ni No Kuni, the original Ni No Kuni, a lot of that battle system, the familiars, is very Pokemon-esque.
Right. Even Final Fantasy 13 too.
Yeah,
like,
really.
Your third-party member is like a random monster that you can capture.
It's just, it's crazy. It's weird to think, because Pokemon feels like such a... I know we're going to keep talking about Castlevania, but just kind of like a side thought. Pokemon just feels like such a... That's its own world. Like, there's not a lot of stuff that does Pokemon the way Pokemon does Pokemon. There's, of course, you know, like, fan games that kind of do something similar, but there's not really anything that I can see that really... like, tries to do what Pokemon did, which is surprising, because almost every other game, like, you would see clones of.
Right.
I can't think of a lot of Pokemon clones.
Yeah,
can honestly, you? Like, at least ones that were super popular. I'm sure there was some that were made, but, like, none that really took off.
Yeah, like...
Even are infamous, for that matter.
Right, right,
like, at least for the known for the opposite reason, that it was just bad or shameless. it's interesting to me to see how much... of the game of Pokemon shows up in other games, and the fact that it kind of shows up here in Castlevania they did it in a good way, because it didn't feel like Pokemon, but you can definitely tell like that was a very Pokemon idea.
Right, yeah, just like the evolution nature and just having like that familiar with you to battle with all the time.
The gameplay itself was just, other than the innocent devil system, the gameplay is kind of simple. It's just a hack and slash.
Yeah.
And that's not to say it's a bad thing. You know, God of War has a simple combat system, but it's fun. Like, the combat feels effective. It feels fun to go through. The dodge is easy. In general, it's just fun. It's nice. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, the combat system's smooth. The enemies are fun. Boss fights are really fun. The one thing that I struggled with my first playthrough and actually kind of structured more for my second playthrough that's not really highlighted in the game as much as I think it should be is the steel mechanic.
Okay.
So they kind of introduce it to you. They let you know it's part of the game. I believe they even let you know that, hey, this is how you get some of the more rare items.
Okay.
Through this steel mechanic. The thing is, this is how you get most of the items in the game.
Is just by stealing from enemies?
Yeah. So, okay. Another like mechanic of the game is that you can build your weapons of all types, whether, you know, again, sword, knuckles, spears. You
Sonic.
Build it, yes.
Sorry.
but you build them through, like, craft. So you collect the materials, and once you have all the necessary materials, you can build a weapon. And generally, later down the road, you need base weapons to convert into the higher-level weapons.
Okay.
So, and a lot of the times...
Yes,
to make it,
I remember this now.
So, a lot of the times, some of the material that you need it, you can only get through... the means of stealing it from an enemy. And each enemy has a different steal mechanic. So at certain points when they're vulnerable, you can then steal from them, or you can attack them a certain way to open up their vulnerability to steal from them.
Okay.
So it was something I totally didn't... I did it a little bit my first playthrough, but I'm like missing half the stuff in the game. So it adds a nice...
Well, it adds a new element that if you would have just gone through without stealing, then you wouldn't be able to, like you just said, you wouldn't experience half the game. And on top of that, it adds a layer of complexity, because then it lets you kind of mix and match your weapons a little bit, right?
Right, yeah.
It mix and match like your inventory a little bit more.
Right, so it plays really nicely with that innocent devil mechanic and evolving it through the different weapon type means. And again, it gives another flavor to that combat. Like, it's like you get to kind of experiment more. Like, some of the enemies, once you start doing that combat again, then it doesn't get old quick. Because then you're like, oh, I haven't stolen from this enemy yet. Let me try and figure out what the best way is
to
open that opportunity. So it makes it fresh.
And I think that's a really important thing to note, because a lot of times, you know, people can, I mean, I guess it's kind of a fault of the game if they don't advertise the steel mechanic very well, but I mean, I didn't even know about it. I still had a good time with it. But a lot of times, it's always unfortunate when you play a game and you miss half the mechanics, and you find out, oh, that's how you're supposed to play this game, and it makes the game so much more enjoyable.
Yeah.
But okay, so the gameplay itself is pretty simple. It is the hack and slash is steal. It's a hack and slash game. It has a stealing mechanic. It has the innocent devil mechanic, which we talked about. And each of the innocent devils can do different things. I think you can only summon one at a time, I believe. I think you have to... I think I don't know if it's at a save station, but I don't think you can just switch out innocent devils on the fly, even in between battles. I think it has to be at specific locations. Do you remember? I'm blanking on... I just played this like a month or two ago.
Yeah, it's... I'm blanking on it, too. I forget if... Yeah, if it's dedicated locations, which I believe... If it was, it would make sense if it was Julia's shop.
I think you can only switch them out of the Devil Forges.
Okay.
And the Devil Forges, actually, to kind of tie it into story, which was the next thing we were going to jump into, the main character, Hector, was a Devil Forge master, which I didn't know what that was. Do you know what that is? I looked it up now, but I didn't know what that was.
I only know because, actually, the Castlevania series on Netflix... has Hector as a pretty main character in the second season.
I still have not watched the second or third season of the show. I've watched the first one.
I was blown away when I saw them mention Hector, and I was like, "Well, is this the Hector I think it is?"
And
they introduced Devil Forge Mastery, and I'm like, "This is amazing that they were able to bring a character that I thought from a game that." Maybe seems
well,
like that.
I looked up something interesting. In terms of the Castlevania timeline, this is like third chronologically, apparently.
Right.
Yep. It takes place right after Castlevania 3, I believe, is where they said. Like, it's supposed to take place right after that.
Yes, because you encounter Trevor in this game, which would make sense.
And Trevor... Yeah, you encounter Trevor Belmont, who was the main character of Castlevania 3, I believe,
yes.
Right? There's too many Belmonts. And, like, Hector, you would assume is a Belmont, but he's not a Belmont.
Nope.
He's one of the two Devil Forge masters who has served Dracula, but he later defected, which is why you can see this here. And he is enraged with Isaac, who is the other Devil Forge master, for the death of his beloved Rosalie.
Yep.
And that is, like, the... big crux of the story is that according to this, and this is actually according to Igarashi, you know, one of the main guys in the Castlevania series, actually the director of this game he's one of the directors, and he's the producer is Koji Igarashi, and he's the guy that who created Symphony of the Night.
Right.
He was the guy that kind of revamped Castlevania from what it was to what we know it is now. And in the Castlevania timeline, hold on, let me look it up. Let me open it up real quick. Let me see if they just have it listed here. Yeah, so it looks like the main timeline is Castlevania Lament of Innocence is the first game in terms of chronology, not in terms of being released, but in terms of chronology of the story. Castlevania Lament of Innocence, followed by Castlevania 3 Dracula's Curse, followed by Castlevania Curse of Darkness, which is where we're at now. Then after that, you have the dreaded Castlevania the Adventure for the Game Boy. For the Game Boy, which is awful.
Oh, man.
That game is so awful.
I have PTSD from that game, playing it on the bus, never being able to get past like the first two stages.
Yep. And then the game after that is Castlevania 2 Belmont's Revenge. Then you have the original Castlevania. Then you have Castlevania 2 Simon's Quest. I don't know what the difference is. What is Belmont's Revenge? That's the Game Boy game. Yeah.
So, which I think is a lot better than the first one, I think.
I mean, it makes sense. They had a chance to learn everything. And then you have Harmony of Dissonance, Rondo of Blood, Symphony of the Night is the one after that. And then apparently there was a radio drama.
Huh.
There's a radio drama of Castlevania. What? I'm going to look into this after we're done recording. And then you have Order of Ecclesia. And there's a lot more. I don't feel like reading it all. I was going to keep on scrolling, but there's a lot still to it.
There's a lot of Castlevania.
There's a lot. There's so many. So Curse of Darkness is set in the year 1479 and takes place 3 years after the events of Castlevania III, Dracula's Curse. So even though Dracula was defeated by Trevor in Castlevania III, his curse still continued to ravage Europe and the European countryside. I'm reading this, I'm paraphrasing off the wiki just so that way people don't yell at me for plagiarizing. This is the Castlevania wiki. Though I've never been yelled at for it, but I still want to make sure I give credit. And it spreads disease and mob violence, which is a very specific thing. But now, which mob are you talking about? Is it you talking about like a bunch of Italians came in and like
Mamma Mia? I got to my pitch for.
You come to me in the day of my daughter's haystack. That doesn't make any sense.
We'll just roll with it.
And so amidst all the devastation, Hector, who is formerly a Devil Forge master who worked under Dracula and betrayed him sometime during the events of Dracula's curse, he grows disgusted with Dracula's brutal methods and he leaves Castlevania to live among the humans, settling down in a peaceful life. Hector's fiance is accused of witchcraft and burned at the stake, and he learns that happened because of another former forge master, Isaac. And seeking his revenge, Hector chases his former colleague back to his old home and back to the demonic life he believed he had left behind. And that is the premise of Castlevania Curse of Darkness. And the game begins there with Hector arriving at an abandoned castle to confront Isaac. And they just kind of banter back and forth, some pithy comments here and there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, PS2 voice acting at its average.
It wasn't awful.
Yeah, it was just average.
Yeah, like I really enjoyed the cutscenes, and I enjoyed, especially at the time. I thought Hector's voice actor was really good, actually. Kind of had that like feeling of lament and stuff like
remorse
that.
for the loss of his wife. This summary I'm trying to paraphrase is off of Wikipedia now. So he goes to confront Isaac, but because Hector has been he kind of has lost a lot of his abilities over time because he's been living among humans now for a little bit. So Isaac kind of scoffs at it and makes fun of him and basically says he dares him to regain his power so they can settle their score in a satisfying way, quote unquote. And Hector reluctantly accepts the challenge and starts hunting his former friend across the Transylvanian countryside. And what was unique about this game is that unlike a lot of the other Castlevanias, a lot of it did not take place inside of the castle, inside of the Castlevania itself. A lot of it was the countrysides and the forests and the woods in the build-up to that. You do eventually get to Dracula's castle towards the end of the game, but he meets a lot of different people along the way. You find out one of them is, in fact, Trevor Belmont. You meet a man named Zed, who is a kindly holy man who provides him with reliable information about Isaac's whereabouts. And Saint Germain, who's a mysterious time traveler who presses him to abandon his quest. And you find out, spoiler alert for the game, of course, you find out that Zed is actually Death himself.
Yep.
Which I guess you could kind of see it because it, I don't know, because I was going to say maybe if you spelled Zed backwards, it'd be like Dez, which is like death. That was a stretch. That was a bad stretch. That wasn't even clever. It
sounds like a bad metal band.
And it's not, it would be Dez. It'd be Dez because Dez is like D-E-A-Z. Zed is Z-E-A-D. So, I mean, I guess it kind of looks like dead. Zed instead of dead. But anyway, so you find out that Zed is actually death, and then Saint Germain is just kind of like, it's hard to explain what he is. He's kind of like just someone who tries to keep the timeline in check, almost.
Yeah, and that's actually an interesting character. I forget if that's the same Saint Germain that's in, again, the new Castlevania show for season 2.
I would assume it has to be, because at the end of this game, Saint Germain departs for the distant future, wondering how the struggle between mankind and Dracula will end.
Mm.
So Saint Germain just kind of seems someone who's kind of outside of the... who's outside of... time or outside of this world. It's a very strange thing. And he leaves because he leaves some cryptic comics about having a new destiny emerging for Hector. So I guess his whole point was, like I said, to kind of keep destiny or fate or whatever, what have you, like kind of in, keep the timeline in check,
right,
is what he kind of seems like his role is. And eventually, you know, he does meet Trevor, but Trevor doesn't trust him because Hector was a former Devil Forge Master. Eventually, Trevor does decide to trust Hector, and he uses his own blood to unlock a parallel world called the Infinite Corridor. This takes a left turn now, which is just wild.
Okay, yeah, so that is the exact Saint Germain, because this whole topic comes up in the show.
It does?
Which is very interesting.
Does it explain a little bit more?
It does a little bit. You kind of see the reasoning for why Saint Germain wants to go to the Infinite Corridor.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's involving a love interest, mainly. So, and I think even, and this could be a spoiler, you do see a glimpse of Dracula in the Infinite Corridor.
Okay.
So Saint Germain might be able to kind of vision Dracula in the timeline when he's about to be reincarnated.
Oh, because he can see him in the Infinite Corridor.
Right, yeah.
Interesting.
It might be a stretch, but that's at least a little
bit. But that's weird, because I like the way this is written here makes it sound like Trevor is the one that uses his own blood to unlock, to get Hector into the Infinite Corridor, not Saint Germain. But however, so then it continues. Because the corridor is supposedly where Isaac is hiding.
Okay.
And when Hector fights a Doulahan, I guess it's a type of enemy, in there, it's an evil glyph channels his energy and uses it to summon a new incarnation of Dracula's castle. Isaac, who intended this all along, cruelly stabs Trevor and leaves him for dead. So Isaac, you know, that he was trying to get, you know, Hector to do this all along so that way they could bring Dracula back. The whole timeline's confusing. And it's all, these games are always so complex when you kind of, you know, when you kind of like look at it from a macro perspective. But Hector enters the new Castlevania and he fights his way through and defeats Dracula pretty much. I mean, it's as simple as that. And that's also where you find out that Zed is actually Death. And Zed appears to confirm that he explained the Devil Forge Masters were supposed to fight to the death, and that Hector would become the vessel for Dracula's next reincarnation.
Right.
So he secures Isaac's body for the purpose of that, and I guess it was whoever was going to die would be the new body for Dracula. But I guess you defeat death once again.
Yep.
you defeat death, and Hector proceeds to fight Dracula, who is unable to control Isaac's body fully because, you know, you defeated death, so the thing couldn't go through all the way. And he uses his Devil Forge Master powers to lift the curse. And Julia comes to his rescue, which I forget who Julia is now. It's mentioned prior.
Yeah.
And I can't remember. Hold on. Oh, Julia is a young witch in exile who turns out to be Isaac's sister.
Okay, I forgot that piece. Because Julia makes an appearance almost like in the beginning of the game, because she's kind of like the shopkeeper for you, so you can buy items from her and things like that. So she's very present in the game.
Okay.
And so I forgot that detail that she was Isaac's sister. She's almost that calming presence in the game.
Okay.
You can kind of tell, like, and this is what I think the game does really well, and it's a nice break from like that Metroidvania type of style.
Mm-hmm.
Is again, like you mentioned, you go through the countryside, you go through like aqueducts, you go through like, there's a clock tower, but it's not part of the Castlevania, at least I don't think it is.
Not that you remember, at least.
Yeah. So you go through all these like really cool sections, and you can tell like the journey is like grinding for Hector. Like, he kind of just wants to get this over with.
He just wants to avenge his wife's death.
Right.
His, you know, the love of his life that was murdered because of Isaac.
Right. And the game captures that tremendously. And Julia is just kind of like that nice, like, comfort home feeling. When you get to Julia's shop, there's like, and I could talk about the music like in a whole other podcast for this game, but
the music's pretty good. Yeah, the music's very good. We'll talk about the music towards the end of this.
Yeah, but just get into Julia's shop. It's a real nice, calm and like soundtrack for it. Her character presence, I think, is a really nice dynamic to this game.
I always find it interesting with games in the PS2 era where there's a lot of story that is not included up front in the game at all. But with PS2 games, they you know, newer games, a lot of the events that led up to the beginning of this game would have been done in an opening cinematic or through gameplay. Right. But this was all done in the manual, from what I believe. So, you know what? Let me double check that, because I read it all on Wikipedia and their wiki, but it doesn't really... it doesn't really tell you all that much. It doesn't say that in the beginning of the game. Maybe it does. Yeah, in the prologue, it tells you everything and it tells the story. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, yep. there's cinematics in the game.
Yeah, so it does. It does kind of tell you that. I mean, no, there's cinematics. But what I'm saying is that the story of how your wife gets killed, like the major inciting incident that causes him, Hector, to go on this grand quest, is just not shown in the game.
Right.
It's barely talked about. I mean, it's referenced, obviously, because he mentions it, but it's like, if you didn't read the manual, you wouldn't know what's going on.
Exactly.
As to
why
he's doing this.
Yeah, you're just kind of like, oh, you get the premise from, like, current time.
Yes.
But you don't know what led to that.
You know
premise.
He's out for revenge for something. Yeah. And I always find that interesting, because that's definitely, like, a trope of older game design, where it's... They don't show, they tell. And they tell in the manual, which not everyone... I mean, I miss manuals.
I do, too. I do, too.
I miss manuals a lot. But it's funny because, like, we grew up at such a weird time where you didn't really have to read manuals. And we grew up at the tail end of having the manuals be necessary.
Right.
And a lot of the games, at least that I played, didn't need them. You didn't need to look at the manual because you had everything that you needed right then and there.
Right.
So it was just kind of strange. But so the story overall is pretty... I think it's actually pretty satisfying. It's not even that it's that simple. Like, I mean, you just heard me trying my best to explain it. But it overall, I think, was effective, and it made you want to kind of continue on, and it was just, it was something simple. I don't
right,
know, what do
yeah.
you think?
Yeah, it wasn't like, you know, it's not like earth-shattering story
or
anything like that.
It wasn't
too
simple, but it was simple enough that you could follow.
Exactly. It gave you enough, like, you wanted to get to that next section to see what the cinematic would reveal.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted to see who Zed was.
You
kind of wanted to see what Trevor's role in this was. Because, again, Trevor is, like, actually not what I would expect from, like, playing Castlevania 3.
Yeah, because he doesn't seem that... I didn't get to see him in my playthrough of it, but he doesn't seem that heroic in this game.
Yeah, he's like almost like how
he's almost disillusioned with everything.
Yeah.
It seems like,
yeah, like almost enraged slightly. Again, he doesn't have that trust factor with Hector.
Yeah, yeah. Understandably so, because he just spent an entire game fighting Dracula, and this is one of his minions.
Right, right.
Or one of his former minions, I should say.
But yeah, I mean it. There's beauty in the simplicity of it, I'd say. And, you know, you have the motive. You have the supporting cast. Again, nothing like, you know, like some of the marquee games of the PS4. This generation, where they're just beautiful storytelling games.
Well, I mean, like PS2 was such an interesting time era because you had this odd combination of, like, really great storytelling in games and then really convoluted, messy storytelling in games.
Yes.
And games like this, I covered it earlier, but Devil May Cry, the story itself is fine, but it's very it's not great.
Yep.
Like, the character development isn't that strong in them. But then you get to games, you know, like Final Fantasy, you know, like, the character development was nothing but strong. I mean, it has been for a while, but I, like, 10, like, had such good character development, in my opinion.
Right, right.
And so you had that, and then I also, you know, so you had like this weird mix of the two. And then you had games that weren't trying to tell a really in-depth story, like Ratchet and Clank.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just meant to be fun and very whimsical and that kind of thing. So you had this weird crossroads where it was like you had this very strange blend between the two. And now I would say games try a lot harder to get a good story and good characters. Mm-hmm. And there are still games that, you know, don't care that much about it, but when they don't care about it, generally it's because the story isn't important to the game. You know, if you look at games like the Fall Guys, which is like the new craze right now, there's doesn't need to be a story for that. It's a bunch of minigames. Fortnite.
Yep.
I will say what's interesting, at least to me, even though I don't have any interest in playing the game, Overwatch, the storytelling in that is very different because it's not done through gameplay. It's kind of done through ephemeral media outside of it, you know, like comics and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like a lot of the, am I right with that? Like,
And it's like each character they kind of introduce, you know, over time. And kind of develop their backstory through, again, like comics or media.
And it's interesting to see that they're doing it that way, where they kind of, they take the story completely out of the game and they do it all outside of the game, which is very interesting because even in old NES games where you had to read the manual, like you would still play through a story in the game. But if Overwatch, it's not really like that. You kind of, they did an interesting thing. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, because once again, I don't really play it. But from what I can gather, they built their character development is the gameplay, and then the story is everything outside of the game.
Right, yeah. So it's like, I mean, when you play Overwatch, for example, it's just a 6v6.
Yeah.
You have objectives. You have, like, this payload objective. It's very, like, it's just fun.
Yeah.
They started to incorporate seasonal events and like certain missions, and it would kind of open up that story a little bit more to kind of see like for these special events, you could only play as certain characters because that's who pertain to that the event going on.
So once again, they're using character development through gameplay.
Right. And then
it's interesting.
Yeah. And the biggest thing is because you don't know, like, you know a little bit, but you don't know why, like, these payload movements are happening, or, you know, the 6v6 and all that stuff. So they started to like release like video clips or things outside the game that pertain to certain characters or certain events.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Winston, the scientific gorilla man, things like that. So.
You would have to describe. I mean, I'm glad you described that for me because I'm serious. I don't play Overwatch, so other than like the really pop, other than May, I don't know any of them.
Right, right, yeah. So it's not a typical way of doing it, but you know that's the joy of having like these types of games nowadays.
Yeah,
and the PS2 came like it really is a marquee system, I think, because you had the PS1 that opened it up. So you had the cinematics become available.
You had a lot more outside the box ideas too, with games like Jammer Lammy and Pa Rappa the Rapper. And,
yeah, yeah.
There's a lot more space for that kind of game design, like strange, off the wall type of stuff.
Right.
And you still got that a little bit on the PS2, but it was much more refined.
Right. Yeah. And again, the PS2 kind of took everything that the PS1 made available. Made it better, made it more accessible, more powerful. So now you get like the Final Fantasy IX cinematics.
Mm-hmm.
Still hold up today, in my opinion.
I still think they look good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's actually a PS1 game.
I mean, those are all pre-generated graphics, so that's just a video that they're playing.
Right, right. But the system gave that capability because at the time, the N64 didn't have the space for it.
There is like only one game that I think that does that, and it's not even that they had space for it. It didn't have the capability to do it. It didn't have the capability to play to stream media,
right?
Or something like that. There was the Resident Evil 2 port over the N64, I think, was like, people are still amazed. Like, how did you get that video on the cartridge? Because it doesn't seem possible. But anyway. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, to me, like, the ability of those cinematics and the ability of, like, just what the PS2 could do at the time, it just really opened up a lot of possibilities for games and, like, how they went about storytelling or gameplay and things like that.
Oh, 100%. And, I mean, I do think that there's, you know, this game, the storyline was fun, but it was, I just don't think it was told all that well. But at the same time, I don't think it was the worst that I've ever, definitely not the worst that I experienced on the PS2.
Yeah.
And it was definitely told better than a lot of other games that have tried to tell stories and just do it poorly. With that said, though, let's move on. Let's kind of bring it back to Castlevania Curse of Darkness. The visual. Let's talk about the visuals. I think one of the criticisms of this game was that while the game itself looked fine, there was a lot of empty space in a lot of the hallways. And I definitely agree with that. Yeah. I think visually it looks really nice. I think Hector looks really good. I think the cat, like all the different locations look nice. They look pleasing. Even, you know, even for a PS2 game, it has that PS2 feel and it looks good. Yeah. But there's not a whole lot, and there's not a lot of variety to the enemies for the most part. It's very simple, and that kind of took a little bit away from it for me, because, like, you look at games like Devil May Cry, and even though I didn't like that game because I'm bad at it, but even though I didn't like the game, that game had so many visually interesting things to look at. Mm-hmm. And the design of Castlevania, I don't think necessarily works. Or I shouldn't say it works, but, like, I do think that it warrants something that's a little bit more visually interesting than what we got, if that makes sense. Especially because the old games had such great visuals.
Right, yeah.
I mean, and when I, at the time of us recording, the next episode for the summer of PS2 is, that's actually coming out tomorrow, is Shinobi for the PS2.
Ooh, nice.
And that game had similarly had really simple, like, it was very empty, but that game was all meant for straightforward linear action.
Right.
This, it's still meant to be straightforward and linear action, but it's like, that's not its sole focus. Like, its focus is more on just is more on other mechanics other than just hack and slash. You know, there's the innocent devils, there's the steel mechanic. It encourages you to just kind of explore around a lot.
Right.
And I mean, it was a kind of a toned down Metroidvania in a sense, because there was backtracking and exploration and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Shinobi wasn't like that. So you can kind of forgive it for having not a lot to look at in the levels, because the main purpose was get through the levels as fast as possible. Like, don't bother looking at these things. We're keeping it simple because we want you to, like, treat this like a speed run.
Right.
And I actually talk about that with my guest on the episode. His name's Cade, from the Gaming Memories podcast. Shout out. And yeah, that's why that kind of seems that way, at least to me in retrospect. With this, since there wasn't a whole lot to look at, I was kind of disappointed with it. You know, what do you think, though?
Yeah, especially because, again, you do kind of backtrack in this game, and it is designed for that. Like, you're supposed to backtrack, you're supposed to be like, oh, wait, I think I know how to steal from this enemy now, or be able to collect more material in general. So, yeah, you can tell it was planned for straightforwardness, but kind of bringing it back, there would be times where I'm like, yeah, I'm kind of done with this area, like, I'm bored with it. There's nothing, like, once you get over that initial introduction to the new area, after you play through it, it doesn't offer anything else once you're done. There might be, like, some new secret areas to get to, but for the most part, like, once you've traversed through that area, going back to it, it's just kind of like,
there's not much to look at anymore.
Yeah, it almost becomes more like an errand at that point.
And it's not even to say that they look like the visuals actually look bad.
No,
it's
no,
just
not
that
at
they're not that visually interesting. Like, it's not bad graphics, it's just kind of dull.
Right, yeah.
And that's why I can describe it.
Yeah, and again, like, to your point, there's just a lot of space. Mm. And that's generally, like, for a lot of And granted, this is nowhere near a sandbox game or open world game, but generally for me personally, like sandbox games, I tend to lose interest pretty quickly if it's a lot of like just going back and forth or like different spots, because like I just lose interest in the area. So yeah, that's just more personal preference, but I think in a game like this, empty space and combined with the need for backtracking doesn't work.
I agree. Yeah. 100%. Anything else to talk about in terms of visuals?
I
feel like there's not, like, I'm always at a loss for how to describe visuals, because it's like, yeah, how else do you say other than I like them or I didn't like them? And right, we gave reasons, at least. It wasn't just like, oh, I thought they looked like shit. It was more just kind of, you know, like we said, there wasn't a lot there. But
yeah, I mean,
I can't think of much else, in all honesty, in terms of the visuals.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing you could add is the variety of weapons in this game does add a lot of cool flavor to it. Something that I don't really typically see in this era.
Okay.
I think there are some games that definitely have it, but this one, like, there were so many weapons, and they all had a unique visual for it. There's even...
Well, I mean, there's other games, like Ratchet & Clank is known for its variety of weapons, too.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I guess to me, like, a hack and slash game like this, you usually, like, all right, you have, like, maybe a handful of weapons
that you can cycle through. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah.
This, you have the ability to not only create all of them, but they give like a nice, cool visual to go along with it. Like one of the, like, so for the Innocent Devil, they have the pumpkin, which is kind of like a joke.
Yeah.
Although it's fun to have. There's same thing applies to the weapons. Like you can make electric guitar, and if you do it, Hector like plays guitar solos and like bashes the guitar over the enemy's head. Like, that's awesome to me. Like,
that's pretty great.
That's actually something that they obviously didn't need to do. It doesn't technically fit, but
I would say that's more in the lines of gameplay versus visuals. But it's still real. Like, it's attention to detail that I think is really fun, because like you said, like, they didn't have to do that. They didn't have to have Hector play a guitar and then bash enemies over the head. They couldn't either A, not include it at all because it didn't fit the style of the game.
Right.
I actually, you know what I miss? I miss games that do shit like that. I miss games that have joke things just for the, that doesn't fit the aesthetic of the game at all. I miss shit like that. I miss it when, I mean, like, perfect example, GoldenEye. GoldenEye is a great game. You know, it's more serious for the most part. But then you get, like, Big Head Mode.
Yeah,
I want Big Head Mode back.
Exactly.
Man.
Bring it back.
Like, I want these oversized melons of heads just running around, like... And it'd be even funnier if they made it more physically accurate. So, like, you're kind of like...
Yeah, you like stumbling around.
You're stumbling around.
Your aim's all off.
You can't stand upright because your head's too, like, heavy. Just dragging on the floor.
Yeah.
Oh my god, I love that though. I
mean, yeah, it's that creativeness that you sometimes like some of these newer age games tend to, not to say that they're not creative in like their storytelling.
No.
But they're just not creative when it comes to like
jokes.
The extra.
I agree. And a lot of times it's also they tell jokes through situations and dialogue versus, like, perfect example, it's the difference between something like Clerks, which I adore. You know, I'm a huge Kevin Smith fan. A lot of that's very verbal. It's all the comedy isn't slapstick. It's very just kind of ridiculous situations and ridiculous dialogue.
Right.
And it's not to say that, you know, other games don't have that, but it's either the game is entirely that,
right?
Like Sunset Overdrive, which I adore.
Yeah, or like Borderlands,
or something like that. Or it's mostly serious with a couple jokes here and there that are meant to give you, to make you chuckle, not necessarily something that's like ridiculous. I want to see games kind of do where it's like, imagine like the Godfather, right? But then in the middle of the movie, the Three Stooges comes in and slaps some people around.
Right.
That's
right.
How I want games to be again, where it's like, it doesn't, you know, it's, you know, that's not a great analogy because, like, movies, that would ruin a movie versus in a game, you could get away with that because that's actually a good argument for why I like games so much, too. Like, why games are so different, other than the playable aspect of it. But as a medium, you could get away with that shit in a video game because absolutely, it would fit.
Yeah.
Like you could totally make it so you would have the super serious game and then all of a sudden you could turn on a cheat and you'd have big head mode or right. You could get to a specific area of the game that's like, you know, kind of hidden away and there's something weird out there that you wouldn't really expect to see type of thing. You know what I mean? Like movies, you can't do that because if you had something that silly in the middle of a movie, it would completely ruin the tone of the movie. But right. In a game, when it's something that's on the side and you don't need to do and it just developers are weird and want to have fun, that type of stuff is awesome. I mean, what was it? We were watching I was watching GDQ last night. GDQ's on the week that we're recording this, and the guy did a Crypt of the Necrodancer run, and the mode that he played on was literally a joke mode made by the creators that he's like, I don't think this is possible. Like, I just did it because it would be funny. And, like, I miss developers doing that. I miss developers throwing stuff in. Like, this just seems funny to me, so I'm going to leave it in.
Yeah, and it does exist in games. Yeah. Like there are certain situations.
It
like,
just I think, doesn't feel as common.
Yeah, it's like almost like those one-time things. So, like, something that comes to mind is one of the later Resident Evils, I think 7. You can go to a lake, and I think, like, either if you look at it or you fish in it or something, like, you get attacked by, like, the Loch Ness Monster or something that resembles it, and you die, like, instant death. So it's, like, it's fun. It's, like, hilarious, but it's, like, a one-time thing.
And that doesn't fit in with the rest of the game at all because it's so outlandish and ridiculous.
Right. So it's, like, it's there. I think it's just, it's more cinematic nowadays than it is gameplay.
Yes. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so let's move on. We've kind of gone off on a bunch of topics. I like these topics. So I think they've tied in well with Castlevania support. Not Castlevania, but tied in well with how we got to them. You know, it didn't seem completely unnatural. let's talk about the music. You've been wanting to talk about the music.
Yeah.
So I want to let you go because I don't have much to say about it. Not because I thought it was bad. I liked it. But this soundtrack means a lot more to you than it does to me. So I'd like to hear it from your words.
Yeah. So I mean, Castlevania soundtracks in general, I think are solid.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just solid. Like, even, like, the NES games are perfect soundtracks.
Well, I mean, those, you shouldn't even say even. Like, especially the NES games.
Right,
those soundtracks. I mean, hell, one of my favorite songs is from my least favorite Castlevania game, Simon's Quest.
Yes.
Bloody Tears.
Exactly. You know, so, I mean, the music has always been marquee in Castlevania games, and it always sets that tone for, you know, that era or, like, what the game's about.
Yes.
So this game is no different. I'm blanking on the composer's name off the top of my head. I believe
she's talking. I'll look it up.
Yeah, I believe she's done.
It's Michiru Yamane.
Yes.
And then Yuka Watanabe.
Yeah, I believe they've done music for other Castlevania games, if I remember correctly.
I will keep looking up while you're talking.
But they phenomenal job with this game. The soundtrack doesn't pop, like, nothing like Bloody Tears.
She's done music for Symphony of the Night. She did the music for Rocket Knight Adventures.
Okay, yeah,
She did Castlevania Bloodlines. She did TMNT Fall of the Foot Clan.
Yes.
And she's done pretty much, since Symphony of the Night, she's done pretty much all the Castlevanias. You have Dawn of Sorrow, Curse of Darkness, Portrait of Ruin, Order of Ecclesia, Harmony of Dissonance, Lament of Innocence, Aria of Sorrow. She also did Suikoden 4 and 3, not 2 or 1. Sorry, I was trying to, like, see it, like, reading through her credits. I'm like, is it on here? I don't see it. And she actually did the music for the Bloodstained games, Curse of the Moon and Ritual of the Night.
Yes, that's right.
So, yeah, she's done a lot.
Yeah, and she captures this, like, sense of, I don't know what you want to call it, like, the ambiance of these games very well. And
you got that right. Aesthetic ambience.
Yeah.
Aesthetic ambience, same diff.
Using my high class words here. but yeah, and each area has a distinct soundtrack and it fits well. Like the aqueduct area has like a nice, like what you would expect from like an action water type space. The castle like that you start in has like the very like upbeat, like let's get into the game type of soundtrack, similar to Symphony of the Night. So it's just a very all around solid soundtrack. I have it downloaded on my like Gen 2 iPod that my last car had like a hookup for. Oh my god, that
was years ago. And it's like, so weird to think that iPods were such a flash in the pan.
Hey,
they went strong for like 5 to 10-ish years, mm-hmm, yeah, and then they just disappeared.
Yeah, because Apple killed its own medium by introducing the iPhone.
Yeah, and it created a whole new medium.
Yeah, yeah.
Or a whole new type of way to listen to music. It's so weird, though, to think about.
Yeah, but, yeah, like, I just remember my last car had, like, an aftermarket stereo with the iPod hookup. I had the soundtrack downloaded to it, and I would just play it when I drove to, you know, whatever, school, work. I love video game music in general. This soundtrack, mostly, I would say, due to the game and its presence that it had on me, the soundtrack benefited from that, no doubt. So it just stuck with me. It's just one of those soundtracks that, you know, again, I don't think it has any, like, bangers, quote-unquote, but it's just solid.
That was the nerdiest one. It doesn't have any bangers, quote-unquote, and no bangers
here. No sour pleases in the chat. Which, until this GDQ I finally put together, that means, like, good soundtrack or whatever it means. I was like, oh, they're talking about the song.
Sour Pleases.
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
Whenever you see like a ton of Sour Pleases in the chat, apparently that means for the music.
We are too old to understand Twitch.
Yeah, I
stream and I still don't understand. there's a guy who was using an emote and it was the Feels Bad Man emote.
Mm-hmm.
But because of something on my end, it just kept saying Feels Bad Man. It didn't show the emote. And I'm like, the fuck's this guy talking about? I was so confused. I was like, what is going on here? What feels bad?
Come on, man.
And then when I realized that it was an emote that just wasn't showing, I'm like, this makes a lot more sense now.
Yeah, there's a lot in the Twitch gen that I just completely over my head.
Well, it's just Twitch is such a uniquely, like, it's weird because Twitch isn't, it's not new. I mean, it's newer. Like, you'd say it really rose to prominence in, like, the mid to late aughts, not aughts, sorry, 2010s, you know, like 2013 to now-ish.
Yep.
And now it's, you know, it just keeps growing. But streaming video games was not something you really saw that much because there wasn't a lot of availability to do something like that.
Right. And even if you could, there's not the interactivity that Twitch provides with the
chat. And like that was a lot of it was just done by third parties. Like Streamlabs helps a lot with stuff like that, and a ton of other like add-on and third-party support helps with that interactivity. But it's just funny because it's not like we were old when that started. We were like in our early 20s, so that was like that would have been prime age for us. But like, because that wasn't our world, we didn't pay attention to it the last, like, what, 3 to 4 years? And by then, we're like, I mean, I'm only 31, but still, like, it feels like a whole world just passed me by.
Right, right.
And I'm just kind of discovering, it's cool to discover it now, but it's weird because I feel so fucking old just talking about it like this way, but because we're not old. It's just that it's just, you know, everything changes just so fast, so it's so easy to get, get caught behind.
Right, yeah.
Get left behind with everything.
Yeah, and it's mainly just like that. Like, this is, I would consider Twitch and streaming in general, like, that's this current gen's
YouTube.
Like, not even YouTube. It's just their main source of entertainment. Like
YouTube and Twitch, yeah. Man. Those are the. I mean, well, like YouTube for us is like Twitch to people like six, right, like yeah. 5 or 6 years younger than us. Don't get me wrong, YouTube is still popular, but like YouTube was the new and exciting thing for us when we were going in high school and in college.
Yeah.
Now Twitch is the new and exciting thing for people in high school and college.
Yeah, and even like kids.
Yeah. Oh, and yeah, and kids too. Yeah, I mean, it's just. It's so weird to think that like a lot of people didn't know what entertainment was like before YouTube and Twitch. And it's interesting because I actually prefer Twitch over it's weird. I like watching YouTube videos more than Twitch streams. And nothing against any Twitch streamers, it's just not always my cup of tea. Like I actually I respect the hell out of Twitch streamers because I get after like 3 hours of streaming, I'm like, "All right, I'm ready to go." And I'm like, "I don't know how these people do it for 8 hours."
Right. Yeah.
It's so exhausting. But like I was thinking about it, I like to watch YouTube videos more than Twitch, but like YouTube right now is a shit show in terms of like trying to make a living off of that.
Right.
It's so hard to do even for established creators, let alone new creators trying to build it up from there because they kind of have sold out to their corporate overlords. Yeah. Much. And it's weird because Twitch is owned by Amazon, so it's not like Twitch isn't also part of a corporate overlord, but there's a lot less oversight on the community than YouTube does to its content creators. Like there's a lot more leniency and there's a lot more room for creativity.
Right. Yeah. And it's like one of the, I would say it's like with these platforms, you just never know when, you know, it could change at the, you know, drop of a dime. Like, you know,
what I like about podcasts as a medium is that for online video content, YouTube is pretty much the only profitable game in town.
Right.
What's nice about podcasts is that there's so many hosting sites. I use Libsyn to host mine, but you know, there's Anchor, which is completely free. There's also Podbean. There's also Himalaya, which my friend Erica uses. And there's just so many different hosting sites now. And it's such a good market because unlike YouTube where like if you get kicked off YouTube you're pretty much fucked,
right? Yeah,
because you have Vimeo, but there's not a lot of people that watch Vimeo, and Vimeo is usually the professionals, like that you're talking like Hollywood studio types that use Vimeo a lot. And like at least, and even with Twitch though, like you still have YouTube gaming, you have Facebook gaming, there's competition. YouTube doesn't have competition really, like not, you have what, Pornhub?
It is becoming a little bit more competition for YouTube if you want to classify it, but yeah.
Oh my god, I have no idea. But yeah, if you're a YouTube content creator, like YouTube's the only game in town, so it's not like you can go somewhere else. And that's why you see a lot of YouTube content creators subsidizing their income, or supplementing their income from YouTube with, you know, in video advertisements. Right, longer the advertisements from YouTube.
Right, because they can actually control that.
They can control that, exactly. But then you still have the issues with the algorithm not pushing their vids and stuff like
that. Right,
it's
just, or like if YouTube decides to implement more copyright stuff, like which has definitely impacted
lots
marquee,
of
yeah, like even like marquee.
Marquee.
Yeah, marquee. I can speak English. No, I can't. But yeah, marquee content providers.
The Nostalgia Critic is a famous one for that. He had a lot of copyright strikes because he does movie reviews. Even though they're completely covered under fair use, YouTube doesn't enforce fair use.
Right. It's all machine based.
Yeah, here's my biggest gripe with tech giants right now. There's no fucking customer service number.
Yes.
You can't call Facebook. You can't call Twitter. You can't call YouTube. You can't call any of them. And it's like, that's fucking atrocious.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of personal information on these sites about you, and you can't reach a help desk rep.
Yeah.
Not even, what is it? I had an issue with, I can't remember the company, but I remember it was definitely a bot that I was chatting with, and they just gave none of their answers were helpful. None of them were helpful. And then there's no way to contact anybody. So if none of their answers, and 9 times out of 10, their answers aren't helpful.
Right.
Yeah. Because it's going to the lowest common denominator. And when you do that, all the people with specific problems, which usually it's the people who are more savvy that don't have those specific problems. Like, usually the people who are more savvy don't ever have to reach out to a bot for contact. They can just go to the FAQ section and figure it out from there. And it's people like that who are getting also screwed because you can't contact anybody then, because you've done everything you can based off of the system they have in place, and the system they have in place is fucking broken.
Right.
Like, yeah. It is fucking atrocious, in my opinion, that that all these tech giants, with the exception of Amazon does, I believe, have a call center.
Yeah, but I mean, that's...
But that's like, also, like, they're selling stuff.
Yeah, too, they're retail as well, yeah.
But, like, you're telling me that fucking YouTube, with all of its fuck you Google money,
yep,
can't afford to get a helpline?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I mean, granted, phone line communication for businesses is always the most expensive, because you always need, like, the actual help desk person there and employed.
But, and then on top of that, just the system itself is probably much more complex than just a...
Right, and thing. All the legal stuff, like, you know, having to make sure you record just in case for things like that. But still, these companies can afford it.
Yes, they can, and yeah, they should.
Yeah.
Because it's insane to me. So it's like, it's going to bother me that I can't remember what company it was that I couldn't do anything with. I was just so mad about it. Like, I had an issue where with the Twitter account for my podcast, where I was trying to set the birth date of the podcast to the birth date of the actual podcast, you know, 2014. Forgot about the terms of service where you can't be under 13, and it locked my account. So I had to submit my photo ID to get my podcast account unlocked, I understand that, but how?
Yeah, they need an option or something.
Well, and I don't even, especially if you sign up as a business, then I feel like, I guess then kids could get bypass it. So I kind of understand it, but like,
yeah.
But it's still like, I was just mad. I was just really mad. I'm so tired of the lack of customer service in tech giants. Like, they make so much fucking money, and you're telling me that they can't do that. I don't know. I'm surprised that we got off on that pet peeve when we're talking about Castlevania Curse of Darkness, but that's not even pet peeve. To me, that's a legitimate problem.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
It just makes me upset.
It's a big problem in this industry, and really, like, especially for the content creators.
I mean, content creators, when you get large enough, then they generally have...
They'll probably have a dedicated rep.
They have a rep
like
at the company. But even so, it's just, I don't know. It makes me really upset. Yeah. Anyway... Castlevania, Curse of Darkness. What a game.
Yeah, baby. Go play it.
Final thoughts. Is there anything else, though, that we... Before we do the final thoughts, is there anything we didn't talk about that you wanted to talk about? Now that we've sufficiently tangented numerous times on this episode.
No, I think we covered a good deal of it. I honestly think it is a undervalued, underrated Castlevania game. I don't really hear it talked about a lot. And honestly, that's why I was so excited when I saw these characters portrayed
in the
Castlevania
show.
Series.
Yeah.
And honestly, if you're a fan of the show and you've watched season 2 and 3, like, play this game. It ties in beautifully with the show. Mm-hmm. The character, the show has Isaac in it as well. So, you kind of get to see it from where they came from in this game. And kind of see, like, granted, there's differences, of course, but I mean, it's having them in the show, and especially being referenced from a game that I generally think doesn't get the credit it deserves.
Yeah,
like, just give it a shot. Obviously, it's an older game, but
I mean, it's the summer of PS2, everything is going to be an older game for this.
And if you know, if Xbox is more your thing, it was dual released on Xbox as well.
Oh, so, okay. I didn't actually know that. For me, I actually enjoyed it. I streamed it one time, got 3 or 4 hours in, got a bunch of follow. I actually met a friend on Twitch who's really, really nice. His name's Blue. I'm going to be so mad at myself that I can't remember his full handle. Because we started following each other and watching each other's streams. Gathering Blues, that's his name. I just haven't seen him stream nearly as often as he used to, but he's such a nice guy, and he loved this game, so he was watching me play it, and we kind of struck up a friendship and whatever. He lives in Spain. He's a really nice guy.
Nice.
And yeah, I liked it. I really did. Other than like my issues with the empty landscapes and geography, it was a fun game. The graphics are appealing. The music's really good. The gameplay is fun. I definitely give it a shot. So with all that said, that wraps it up for this episode for the summer of PS2, for this episode of Still Loading. Justin, thank you for joining me for this episode.
Thank you, as always, sir.
As usual, you can follow me. Actually, before we get to me, is there any social media you want to plug?
If you're into anime, I'm pretty much down the weeb hole for a while now.
That's my high school band's name, the Weeb Hole.
But yeah, I'm just on Twitter at Kitsu Ninja, which is KitsuNG. Hold on, I can spell. I got a degree.
NINJA.
I got a degree. Damn it, KITSU.
SU. Sorry, no, that wasn't even a good joke. Here, I'll look it up for you just so that way. Okay. KITSU NINJYA.
That's it.
That's how you spelled ninja.
But yeah. Mainly just a lot of anime stuff. And I love talking about games too, so but yeah, that's it for me.
As usual, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. If you want to reach me, you can email me StillLoadingContact@gmail.com. You can also go to the website, StillLoadingPodcast.com. Check out the Podbear Network, the network I'm a part of. If you want to support the show, you can do it in a number of different ways. You can give it probably the easiest for all of you, and actually probably one of the most beneficial for me, is just giving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you're using. That helps with exposure of the show so more people can find it. If you want to support the show monetarily, you can go to patreon.com/stillloadingpod. Even just $1 a month will help grow the show. And the most important plug I have is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of children receiving inpatient care at hospitals. So you can go to their website, bitbybitfoundation.org, and consider donating. And that should do it. So Justin, I already thanked you before, but thank you again for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you.
And with all that, I will see you all next time.
I think Josh needs a better beard to be part of the Beard Pod network. Just saying.
You're not wrong.